podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Don't Nearly View system, Diogo. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
It is the Anfield Rap Weekend. The Anfield Rap Weekend are coming up. I'm speaking to Tim O'Tierney about T Street Band's new album. I'm also speaking to Rory Smith about a piece he's written about Manchester United, but more about the way a cycle can engulf a football club. We'll also, in the studio in front of me, I have Paul Senior. We'll be speaking to him about matters pertaining to football and also Motel's fifth birthday. I've got Amelia and Melissa ready, made up to have everybody contributing to the show this week, but I need to open it with an appeal. Michael Woodburn, or Young Mike, as a lot of people who go to the match will have known him, passed away this week in tragic circumstances in Norway. His mum Jackie and the rest of the family are devastated. There is a GoFundMe appeal in order to help her financially in this situation, with reference to her being able to go to Norway, get him sent home, and then for the funeral and all of that sort of matters. Everyone who's close to Mike misses him a great deal. I was in Hotel Tia last night and a lot of his friends were there, and it was fair to say that people were so upset and just devastated by what's happened. He will not be forgotten and he will be missed. If you'd like to contribute for this, you can find his GoFundMe page. It's gofundme.com/Michael-Woodburn-RIP. So you can find that one on there. It's got a £15,000 goal. It's already on £11,000 and the Anfield Rap will be contributing to that through its live show that we're doing before the Cardiff game in Liverpool. So at 12 p.m. At the Kane's Brewery Village on Parliament Street in Liverpool, 12 p.m. start before Liverpool play Cardiff. It's £7 a ticket, and every ticket bought, every penny of every ticket bought, will be going towards that fund as well. But any donation that anyone who's listening to this can be made would be greatly appreciated. All right, then. Last night was Liverpool versus Chelsea in the Carabao Cup, and Liverpool got beat 2-1. Mel Reddy, Liverpool are allowed to lose games. They lost this one to a moment of fantastic magic from Eden Hazard.
Yeah, I think consistently one of the best players to come to the ground and put on a show, even when he doesn't score and you watch him and he's in full flow, you tend to appreciate what a good player he is. And I think the only question mark against him has been, can he do those kind of things regularly enough? I don't think he has too often, but when he does, wow. And you know, loads of people were saying, oh, awful defending, but you know what, that's not football. If you're looking at that goal and you're talking about the defending, you're doing it wrong.
I think there's definitely an element to that, Adam, in that, you know, if one of ours scored that goal, and we've got players capable of scoring that goal, the one thing we wouldn't be doing is saying, oh, well, look, he should have made that tackle there, or he should have done that. I think that we've got to, at times, acknowledge that the purpose of brilliant attacking is to make defenders look daft.
Definitely. It was, you know, possibly the best goal scored by an opposition player at Anfield since the last time he did that. And he doesn't. I've watched a bit of Chelsea this season, and obviously he's having a good season. But he doesn't do it every week. He does pick his moments against Liverpool quite regularly, and you know it has got to get us a bit concerned about about what we've got to face on Saturday, which is a game that I've been sort of confident about for a while. And you know it's a pain, isn't it, playing the game in the cup and then in the league as well. It happens quite a lot, but yeah, I mean the goal itself, as you've both said, it was a moment of pure quality, and he was quality from the minute he comes on. You know, that's obviously, it's that sort of substitution. We've seen Liverpool do it in the past in sort of smaller competitions, bringing Gerrard on, and you know the world class player does the world class thing, and you do I think have to hold your hands up. I mean, having said that, if we had had our first choice defence and goalkeeper, I don't know whether he still scores it, but you know, I'm not pulling the any particular defender or whatever to shreds after it.
Yeah, I sort of feel a little bit like Adam does at the end there. I would have liked to have seen how he'd have got on against Andy Robertson and Alisson in that situation, but we are where we are. But I think I think we were talking about this last night. Good players do that, and he is about as good as there is in the Premier League. I'm not quite sure if he's the best. I think Kevin De Bruyne is the best player in the Premier League, but he's been outstanding for a long time in the Premier League, so you've got to expect that from a player of his quality. It's disappointing, but things like that happen. Mohamed Salah's done it for us and put other side to the sword, and you've just got to expect that sometimes world-class players are going to do world-class things, and when they do, you can hold your hands up and sort of take it on the chin, and that's sort of how I feel. I'm a bit more disappointed the nature of the first goal. I think it's poor defending from Liverpool, really. I thought coming off the ground, Mignolet makes a really good save for the first bit, and it is a good save, but I think pushing it back out where it comes, and I think he could palm it away a bit further.
It was a blast from the past, that goal.
It was. It
just felt exactly
well, I sat
like...
there all last night and I felt a little bit like I was watching Liverpool from 2 years ago and I didn't like it, to be honest with you. And that's sort of how I felt all through the game. I was looking at that back five going, it was nostalgic a little bit right, last night, and I really appreciated what we've got now, and I really come to love these lads that we've got now even more, you know, the first 11, just appreciate just how ruthless Jürgen Klopp's been in turning over that back five. And yeah, you can see, for me, it was an image of how much we've improved, and that's what I took away from it.
On the point of the winner, you know, Neil, you said if Liverpool score a goal, we're not sitting there talking about the defending, and Klopp made the point that Roberto Firmino comes on and scores a similar sort of goal against PSG, and absolutely, you know, no one in terms of a Liverpool nature or even a PSG nature criticised how that goal came about, because it was sheer brilliance. But yeah, in terms of looking at the squad and thinking this is a throwback, it, you know, the back line was very much that. But I think what I took away, especially from watching that first half, is how much Liverpool have developed in the period since they all last started together as a back four with the goalkeeper, with Mignolet. And also how much the development is one thing, but the standards and the expectations have risen so considerably on the pitch of what you're expected to do on the pitch, let alone fan expectations. And I think you really saw that from the fullbacks, who just could not operate to the same extent as Andy Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold are doing for Liverpool at the moment. But also, if we're being fair, we have to know that it's, you know, players who haven't really played together. I mean, Fabinho hasn't played with Milner or Keita, or, you know, there's all these, they've not played with the fullbacks before. Klein hardly played last season. Moreno's never kicked a ball yet this season until yesterday. Lovren as well, just coming back from injury. A lot of them, I don't think, are 100% sharp.
I thought, Adam, the unfamiliarity for Liverpool was a struggle early. And I think Chelsea are interested in this, in that I think there's the other thing that we do, which is we ask lots of footballers to play really quite unconventionally. So I think that it's a lot easier to be Fabregas for Chelsea than it is to be Fabinho for Liverpool, as an example of changes that are made. I think Fabregas, yeah, it's a demanding role. He gets an awful lot of the ball, and he's got to keep it moving. But the circle that's around him isn't very big, and it's right in front of his centre-backs right the way through the game. Whereas Liverpool demands so much out of central midfielders, it's become clearer and clearer exactly how much. And I thought for the first half an hour especially, you could see that Fabinho and the players around him were almost like, you're just never where you're meant to be here, mate. You're just never where we need you.
Yeah. There is that. I think that Chelsea managed to get better performances out of their second string than Liverpool did, and there's probably something systemic there. But I mean, you can't really can you measure what's the easier system to play? I'm not sure whether that's a bit of a cop out to say
no,
that.
No, I don't
it's
think
hard.
It is.
I mean, there's literally less players in our midfield trying to do more, I guess. So
I think they have more safety nets. I think their side are set up with a couple more safety. They've not got loads. It's not like you know Hodgson's Palace, but they've got a few safety nets in there, whereas our lads don't have that luxury.
Yeah, I do think that there was that it's. Hopefully that it is just that there's new players and there's rusty players, but it looked like that Chelsea were much, much happier playing in that system, and it wasn't players that have featured much. You know, Kovacic and Barkley both play well. Fabregas, obviously, you know, he's a good player. He's gonna slot in and understand what to do. He's been there years anyway. And I think you can't really say that about our midfield specifically. And I think that, as I say, hopefully it is that you know it's just Fabinho's first proper game, and you know it's I think there's different reasons why. Well, I think Keita plays well. I think it's annoying that Milner gets booked early by the ref, who I thought was bad as ever. Because Milner sets the tone physically for us.
He could be the worst ref in the country.
He could be. Yeah, I was going to say
the worst hairy ref.
He's the worst one with hair. That and very like fascist hair at that too. he is a little like fat Grange Hill teacher or something, isn't he? Anyway, hopefully it is that those players are just growing into the system rather than it being that they, you know, that they'll continue to struggle. But yeah, I mean, and as Mel said about the fullback specifically, there's a combination there of rustiness, you know, sort of specifically Klein, because we were talking about this in the ground. There's rustiness, and there's also a feeling that we've moved past him as a player.
Just on the way the game goes, the first 30, you know, is Adam's grim prognosis there. The second 30, though, Paul, and you and I, we watched the highlights together last night. We don't even necessarily create them all. We end up with a ton of chances. I mean, between 30 and 60, Liverpool really, if they'd have scored three goals, you wouldn't have gone, that's unreasonable. They have really, really good opportunities.
Misses an open goal, doesn't he?
Misses an open goal on 25 seconds into the second half. But even before then, Mane, excellent header, really good ball from Shaqiri after he checks inside. Yeah. It's Liverpool are very creative in that period once they get a foothold.
Yeah, absolutely. It was sort of no surprise how Sarri reacts to that by bringing on his two biggest of guns in Kante and Eden Hazard. But no, back to your sort of point there, it was a game where we were busy, and unfortunately it's becoming a bit of a recurring theme. A side that we know is so clinical just hasn't been clinical enough in these opening eight games. That being said, our record hasn't been too bad. But, yeah, for me, like I was pleased with sort of the amount of chances we were creating. I thought Naby Keita was excellent. Really sort of cured a few creeping doubts that I'd had about Naby Keita, and just seeing his touch and his ability on the ball last night was really reassuring. And I sat in the centenary, the Kenny Dalglish stand last night, and I got to see quite a lot of him. And yeah, I was really impressed. I thought Shaqiri, especially for the first 60 minutes, was really influential. Started opening them up, some really quality deliveries. I thought towards the end of the game, as Liverpool were chasing it a little bit, his quality dropped off. And I thought he became a little bit desperate with some of the stuff he was doing. But that being said, overall, I thought he played well. Sturridge, it was an interesting one for me. Frustrated me a little bit last night, Daniel Sturridge, and not just because he misses an open goal, but just bits of his play that I thought he wasn't quite as thoughtful. It might be the word, as he was against Paris Saint Germain. It very much seemed like a statement performance that Daniel Sturridge, like this against Paris Saint Germain, was willing to change and adjust and be more like the new Liverpool. And I felt more like it was the more self-aware Daniel Sturridge last night. I thought just little bits of him was frustrating me. But I'll always say, like, you can say that a side will look all right as long as they're creating chances, and Liverpool continue to do that, and I can sort of take half from that.
With one eye on Saturday night, Mel, the one thing you can say is Liverpool, in that half an hour, with what is predominantly, although I thought Sadio Mane was excellent in the game, Liverpool with what's predominantly going to be their second choice attack really wrecked Chelsea's shape. So Chelsea's shape looked great for the first half an hour. It was dominating space, it was dominating possession, it was doing lots and lots of clever things really, really well. And it was as though a flag fell somewhere and the complete opposite happened. That, to me, Liverpool made them look so ragged for 30 minutes. They didn't know where they were on the pitch.
Yeah, and that was, I think, a massive, massive takeaway because, you know, like we spoke about, these players with rustiness, players that are unfamiliar to each other, and players who have yesterday realized just how high the expectations are now and how far they have to climb if they want to regularly be involved. In saying all of that, if you walked out of that game yesterday and Liverpool were winners, you would have thought it was very much deserved because Liverpool created enough in that spell we've mentioned. And I thought as soon as Liverpool realised what Chelsea were about, that they wanted to operate in the half spaces, that Fabregas was basically dictating everything, that they were trying to get Willian involved as much as possible quite early. As soon as Liverpool dealt with all that, Mane went on Fabregas and did a really good job there. They denied Willian space a lot better because his influence just completely dipped. Then there was only one team in it for that period, a very decisive period where Liverpool should have put the game to bed. You know, Sturridge's miss, then he scores that fantastic goal. Then we have opportunities after that. We hit the bar as well. Sturridge hit the bar. Sturridge also played a really good ball. And now I'm struggling to remember who he played it to, but a chance came from that as well.
Shaqiri.
Yeah, it may have been Shaqiri. Yeah. And I thought
Sturridge actually hits the bar just before you move on. He hits the bar just before they get the free kick that they score from. Yeah. It's like the same. It's 1 minute where the game flips.
Exactly, yeah. And I thought Shaqiri caused them a lot of problems. Again, because the variety, he's such a varied player. You don't actually know what's about to come next for him. And Chelsea struggled to sort of know how to handle a Liverpool that aren't really Liverpool, if you get what I'm saying, because the fullbacks aren't really giving you much to think about. The midfield were a little bit dysfunctional or not as functional.
It felt like our pace wasn't there.
Yeah.
There was a lot of space in behind Chelsea, and it felt like even though it wasn't particularly, you know, maybe it is the fullbacks, but, you know, we've got Mane there and, you know, Shaqiri's nippy. Sturridge obviously hasn't got any pace anymore, but it did. It felt like all over the pitch we weren't as quick. We didn't have that pace.
And yet, Chelsea still struggled. And I think if I'm of a Liverpool persuasion in terms of an analyst or coaching staff or even a player, you know, the ones that weren't involved sitting at home thinking about what's to come next, I'm looking at that game and being quite encouraged by it.
I don't know whether we're being slightly generous to Liverpool versus what Chelsea did as well. Chelsea also made 8 changes. You know, this wasn't a Chelsea side that had played a lot of minutes either, and
It is a Chelsea side familiar with each other, though. A Chelsea side that won the title
We could argue about the back five being one that's played together, I don't know how many times, but that would have been our first choice back four, I would imagine.
That back five hasn't played together before, but I might be wrong.
There's a bit of crossover here. So last season, starting centre half partnership was Lovren and Matip.
Yeah.
But the season that.
I think when Moreno was playing, it was Gomez
or Trent. Right back, because the season before it was Klein at right back and Milner at left back. So,
they've all played each other a lot of times.
I'm just being a bit pedantic. I just heard it and I thought it was interesting.
Yeah,
because I thought so as well.
Apologise to me.
I don't think I apologised.
I'm taking that as an apology. No, I'm only joking. I think we've got to consider the fact that Chelsea did make a lot of changes as well. And I think, in simple terms, the game is really just summed up by that bit of magic from Hazard. I mean, I think you can talk all day about him. The only thing that frustrates me with Hazard is that I don't wish he did it every season, but it's almost like he has a year off. Every time I convince myself he's good, he'll decide the year after he's had enough of the manager that he's just having the year off. And I think this year could well be his last at Chelsea, and I feel like last night it was almost like he was going to put on another show at Anfield. He's been to Anfield many a time, and put on a show. But last night he came off the bench and really, really, really impressed.
On us and the changes, Mel, we make those eight changes. My worry is for a few of these now, it is now really sort of flying the plane and building it at the same time in terms of getting performances out of them. You know, we know he needs to rotate. There's an excellent Phil Blundell article on the Anfield Wrap talking about the number of starts Manchester United players have got in seasons gone by when they've gone deep in a number of competitions, and it's striking that there's certain players who just don't even break 40. So we know that they're all going to need to get some time on the pitch, and even going to Solanke, who doesn't even get on in the end because Jurgen Klopp wants to win the game. You know, Solanke doesn't even see it, doesn't see any time. And my worry for a few of these lads is we're going to need them. We're going to need Lallana, and Lallana's, you know, he's not nowhere near that game even. We're going to need them. But it now becomes, he's coming back from his injury. It now becomes, it's tough to see a pathway to blood in a couple of them now, or getting them back away from their rustiness.
Yeah, it is a tough balancing act because you have to, you know, find the middle ground between rotation and rhythm. And the second bit is exceptionally hard for players who are not featuring, and, you know, like with a Nathaniel Clyne, isn't really featuring but has so much to do beyond getting the sharpness, the match, you know, the feel within a match. He has to do so much to get to Trent's level in terms of what he offers to the attack, because Trent becomes an auxiliary midfielder, an auxiliary addition to the front line when he plays. That's just what he does. And, you know, the same with Robertson on the other side. And how you try and get them involved without the League Cup, you know, you wait till the FA Cup or you can't try in lesser games. But I think that, you know, moving forward in the league games, the rotation won't be as heavy. We saw Jurgen Klopp do it last season where it was three changes, two changes.
He's been better at that than he has the wholesale League Cup changes, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Where you can still maintain the core of the rhythm in the side, but give a few people a run out and ensure freshness in whoever you've given a rest to. And that's basically key. And you can do it with a few of... I think defence, for me, I would alter least with Liverpool's rear guard and keeper, because I think it's a really, really solid foundation. And then when you look at the midfield, I think because you already have to pick one off Milner or Keita or Wijnaldum.
We've already sort of started that rotation process with midfield.
Exactly. I think they all know and they all accept. They may not like it that they won't play every game, but they accept that it's necessary for them not to play. So I think it is easier. And with Shaqiri now, we've seen that he is capable. He obviously doesn't do what our current front three do or what any of our midfielders do, but that's what I like. I like the fact that he can do different things, because the opposition, it's hard to prepare if you're thinking you're going to face Sadio Mane and suddenly you're facing Shaqiri.
I think it's probably the most difficult thing to swallow is going to be for the likes of Shaqiri and Sturridge. And you mentioned Dom Solanke there. There's probably a realistic chance now. You don't see Dom Solanke in a Liverpool team until the third round of the FA Cup. You know, an 18 where... But that's the best part of 4 months off. You know, and there was noises coming out of England in the week that they're really disappointed about what's happening with Liverpool and Dom Solanke. Well, it's the position he's in because of the array of riches we've got. I think it's disappointing that he never found himself alone or something like that. But if you're him now, you must be scratching around going, what am I meant to do?
There's certain players who are a risk to play, and I think he is a risk. What game can we risk putting Dom Solanke in? I don't know. I mean, we did it last season. We played Stoke away, didn't we? But, you know, and my point is, I guess, is that there's a lot of players who I don't think that you could really say that about. But I'd say that you probably can now about Clyne. I'm not sure where I'm risking Clyne again.
I was just going to say, he fell into that bracket for me last night where you go, the drop-off is so substantial that I could put up a feasible argument why I'd rather see Rafa Camacho ahead of him, just stylistically.
Or like, you know, I was thinking, God, we could play Fabinho there maybe if Trent got injured.
Yeah.
Just we're talking though in the context that we're currently in at the moment, where we've only got like one or two injury concerns. Yeah. But I mean, you know, as the season kicks on, you're getting to November, and that's when the build up usually starts off, you know, issues, and you just need two attackers or one attacker to be out of the equation for Solanke to then become involved in the mix somehow, not necessarily starting, but in the equation.
Indeed. Long way to go throughout the entirety of the season. Thank you very much to these three. Back with them in a minute or two, but Rory Smith and Timo Tierney to come. Rory, talking about the piece he's written about Manchester United.
Beer 52 is back, and this time it's Balkans. Neil Atkinson here. I've got a complicated relationship with Beer 52. It's beer52.com, by the way, if you want to go and look at it. It's the craft beer club. You get a free case of craft beer if you pay £2.95 postage. You get a magazine with it as well called Ferment, which will look into the Balkans theme. My complicated relationship with craft beer as a whole, not just with Beer 52, is that so much of it's so very delicious, and then it transpires it's ultimately very strong indeed. So do be very responsible with your approach towards this. We'd like you to obviously sample it. They've partnered with us before. They send us things, and we very much do appreciate them. So if you'd like this free case of craft beer, it's beer5252.com in order to claim that free case and to go from there. It's hugely popular, worldwide popular, in terms of being a discovery club for interesting small batch craft beers from across the world. It features amazing beers from up and coming brewers in Croatia, Serbia, I've been reading this out, Slovenia and Bulgaria, such as, my word, a 7.2 citrus IPA from the Garden Brewery. Oh, my days. That just feels overwhelming, to be honest with you. I'd pass that one along to someone else. But there's a very, very solid-looking Pilsner in there, having gone through all of that. You can try your first case for free, and it is £2.95. You get that. You get the eight beers and the magazine. And there's a snack in there as well, which is entertaining. And my word, if you go the 7.2 citrus IPA, make sure the person who's having that gets the snack. It is no minimum commitment. You can just take the free case, try the beers, and see what you think. If it's not for you, you can pause and cancel at any time. There is a 5-star rating for the Montrose Pilot. We do look into this sort of things. Their members do love the service. So beer52.com, that's beer5252.com. It is something that's there for everybody. I think that's really important to understand that. I think, you know, sometimes this stuff gets pigeonholed as being something which it isn't. Very much should be inclusive for everybody. Like everything, really, we can find so much common ground between all of us, can't we, all the way around the world. You can also tailor the box to your preference as well, if you would like to do that. So it's beer52.com. It's everything that you need to know. Joined by Rory Smith, who's written a fantastic piece in the New York Times about Manchester United, which I wanted to talk about, but not to talk about Manchester United as such, although obviously they will feature throughout this conversation, but to talk about the strange thing that happens to football clubs when the perception both inside and outside the football club is you're only ever one wrong step away from a gaping chasm. And that's where United have sort of found themselves. But I've seen that happen to Liverpool sides. I think you've seen it happen to, it sort of happens to Wenger's Arsenal, Rory, that somehow something happens to a football club and they're never more than one bad result away from it being a disaster. And there's nothing they can really do to stop that for a prolonged period, if at all.
Yeah, you can never kind of get away from it. And I think that is absolutely the crucial thing at United. And Wenger's Arsenal, the last 3 years of Wenger at Arsenal, it was literally, if they drew a game, the banners came out, the fans started hiring planes, the booze started, everyone got really upset, and it was literally, if they so much, you know, even if they only won like 2-0, there was a possibility that there was going to be a problem, and that was kind of the most extreme case of it. But it's definitely happened at Liverpool. It's happened at Chelsea a few times where you know that if they drop any points at all, that there's going to be an issue, and I think it manifests in certain ways, and the one that we've seen with United most recently is where really, like, really minor things that don't matter at all, the sort of things that happen all the time at football clubs, happen and are major issues. And obviously Pogba and the Instagram post, the parable of the Pogba Instagram post, that's the most recent one. That sort of stuff happens in football quite a lot. You know, maybe not that exact thing, but, you know, incidents of that scale and that kind of, those misunderstandings. And most of the time, it doesn't matter. But it's a club where, I don't know, like, melodrama's set in, where everyone's watching, looking over their shoulders, where everyone's on a knife edge, where the fans are sort of unhappy and the players are sort of unhappy and the manager's sort of unhappy and there's fragile, fractious relationships at every level. Little things like that suddenly take on this overwhelming significance. And I think the thing that gets missed, and I'm not sure I addressed it quite as well as I should have done in the piece that I wrote, but I think the thing that gets missed with United is Mourinho wants to turn it into a, understandably, wants to turn it into a, an invention of the media. And there's a lot of fans that would be at any club who want to believe him that it is an invention of the media and that actually everything's fine. If only it wasn't for the nefarious journalist, then all would be sweetness and light. But that's kind of missing the point. The point is that they are in the cycle. And as soon as you're in the cycle, the existence of the cycle itself becomes noteworthy. And I think that's really important to remember that the media aren't costing Man United games. The media aren't making Paul Pogba's relationship with Mourinho be sort of strained. They're not making the atmosphere at Carrington, the Aon training complex, or at Old Trafford be slightly sort of fractious. That's not, the media's not actively doing that. There's no kind of third column working inside the Man United playing staff and in the crowd to make there be a story. There is a story there, and that means this cycle exists. And once you are in the cycle, it's really hard to get out of it. And to be honest, short of, I don't know, like a record-breaking winning streak, short of a trophy early on, trying to get the League Cup, obviously, which is, that's the purpose of the League Cup, is it gets that monkey off your back. It's really hard to see how United will ever escape it under Mourinho, because he can win 3 or 4 games, and I made the point in the piece, he can win 3 or 4 games in a row, and everything will look like it's perfect, and he's come out of it. And if they lose the next one, then you're right back where you started, because you are in the cycle.
I think the cycles, I want to talk about, there's a really important paragraph in your piece, which I want to say for Liverpool supporters listening, and any United supporters listening. You've written this: Mourinho has tried everything to inspire his team to do that on a more reliable basis. He's tried pretty much everything in his arsenal. In fact, he's protected his players in public to shield them and criticised them too to ignite a spark. He's changed his team and his system. He's reminded the world of his record. A kind interpretation would see that as an act of reassurance to an uncertain squad, less generous one getting Europe Butlin first. That, forgetting the end of that, the point about this is that when you begin to talk of the cycle, the stress of the cycle means that managers also get themselves into a situation where they do think, I'll do a bit of everything. I'll try this 1 week and this the next. And I do sort of wonder if what at times you could maybe perhaps do with is maybe a little bit of consistency, is the idea of being able to say, I am here, I am eternal, I am going nowhere. And but that in and of itself becomes really tough when you know that the next thing that happens will be someone saying, well, should you be eternal? Should this be, will you always be this version of you? Because if you are, well, we can point at this sporting event that might have just simply happened because they do, and that undermines you further.
Well, yeah, so I think this is, it's really easy to kind of scoff at managers who talk about philosophies and visions and kind of styles of play and the way they work and methodologies and processes, and Mourinho scoffs at it quite a lot, particularly in regard to managers he's decided he doesn't like, so Klopp and Pochettino, he likes Pochettino, but he doesn't like the praise that Spurs get. And where previously it was Wenger and Conte and what have you. You know, he's decided, he's won for mocking people who talk about football in like highfalutin terms, which a lot of the time, to be honest, I've got a lot of sympathy with. So I think we all do take it a little bit too seriously. But there is a huge advantage to being a philosopher manager. And that's that when you have these hiccups, these problems, you can take your players and say, this is the way, this is what we are going to do. Doesn't matter what obstacles come, doesn't matter if we have a setback, this is the way we're going to do this, and this will get us out of it. I have complete faith. And I think the problem for Mourinho is he's never been like that, and that's always been his great strength, his flexibility. But at a time like this, and the same thing happened at Chelsea in 2015-16, at a time like this, you sort of think, well, what is he telling the players to believe in? Because he's tried a little bit of everything from almost as though he's read lots of management books. And in reality, I guess he'll have gone back through his own experience and thought, what worked when I've been in similar situations in the past? And, you know, he's tried to be the hard man by publicly excoriating Pogba. And he's tried to be the reassuring one. And he's tried to draw the fire. And he's tried to be the slightly sort of manic one who demands respect. And he's lashed out and he's been sullen and he's been quiet and he's been loud. He's done everything. And none of it works. And I think that's partly because he doesn't really know what the problem is. I don't think he fully gets why Manchester United aren't better than they are. I think that's something that is still a little bit beyond him. But also, I think because he doesn't have any kind of overriding vision of perfection in his head of what his Manchester United should look like, what he wants them to be, it's really hard for him to point his players and say, this is where we're going, this is our destination. And I think without that, it becomes really easy to just kind of try lots of different things and find that none of them work. So you try something that's different but also kind of contradictory. And after a while, I think players probably get their head starts to spin a little bit, and they're like, well, hang on, I don't really get what you're doing anymore. Like, what is the purpose of this latest action? Why are you dressing down Paul Pogba in front of all of us? What is the purpose of this? It's a little bit, not quite as serious. Remember when Phil Brown did that thing on the pitch at City?
Yeah.
And he sat the whole players down. It's a little bit like that. Like, that was clearly a last throw of the dice from a desperate man. And because it's Phil Brown, we all laugh and ha ha ha, isn't he funny? And then Jimmy Bullard does a brilliant banter celebration the next time they score, and everyone laughs at Jimmy Bullard, the real character. But Mourinho embarrassing probably his best player in terms of his talent and kind of what we Americans would call the franchise player. It's not dissimilar. It's a kind of really last throw of the dice, desperate move to try and get a reaction. And I just wonder if I don't think a lot. I don't think United players kind of hate Mourinho. Certainly, a lot of them. There's no sense of like mutiny as there was at Chelsea. But I think I wonder if a lot of them are kind of looking at him and thinking, don't really know if you know what you're doing. Like, what is the purpose of all of your actions at this point? Where are you taking this? Why are you doing this? And that's really dangerous.
On the cycle point in general, to me, the cycle feels, and maybe I've got to be careful here because we live and breathe football a lot more now, but I think that's one aspect of the cycle, the idea that football now has that sort of 24-hour thing, one way or another, that it imposes on its participants and its audience. The second thing is, I think, with the cycle, the number of points you need to be genuinely competitive within the league is a problem, because it allows there to be, you can win four, like you're saying. Manchester United could, let's say, Manchester United could win the next four, but one or two of them may be in the Champions League, and then there'd only be two league wins, and then they get a league defeat, and suddenly that league defeat, because of the stress and strain of it, is so significant. And then the other thing is the player power. I think all these three things have sort of contributed to this idea of the cycle being a thing, of this thing that you can just get mired in, this quicksand that you just can't get out of.
Yeah, I think journalists generally are guilty of refusing to acknowledge that the media does play. The media is an active participant in events, and I don't want to kind of create the impression that I'm saying not. I don't believe that Manchester United don't seem to be in crisis because the media wants them to be in crisis. Manchester United seems to be in crisis because they keep not winning football matches, and you're totally right. City won the league last year by dropping 14 points. United have already dropped 8. That suggests that they are playing with a really fine margin for the remaining 32 games of the season. Even if City only get 95 points or Liverpool get 90, you still don't have a lot to play with if you drop 8 points in your first 6 games. So that bar is much higher. No question, with social media, we're all a lot quicker to respond with the kind of 24-hour culture that started with Sky Sports News and has been kind of exacerbated by the internet and by the way that the media has changed. Everything is poured over, everything is examined, everything is analysed, everything is scrutinised. That's all fine. But the media does, football is a media construction. The whole of it is played out through both the legacy media and new forms of media. That's where football exists. If it isn't for those forms of media, football is played, but it's not. This conversation isn't happening because if only 50,000 people can see it, then, or can consume it, then it's not that popular. Do you know what I mean? There's not. Yep. It has to have access to millions. Football is a media construct, and to try and separate the media from the event is really dishonest. And you can't claim that you don't have a part to play or an active role in it. And that's where the cycle kind of becomes important, because it is a media cycle, but it's a media cycle that reflects facts and kind of occurs because certain things are happening. It's not invented by the media, but it's played out in it. And I have completely lost my train of thought. But I'm sure whatever you said was completely right. No, I think that once you're in this cycle, it's really hard to escape, just partly because of the bar is so high now, but partly because of the way that everything is reflected and kind of the prism through which everything is passed. And I think that's partly the media, but I think it's also partly fans. I think fans are much less tolerant of any form of failure now as well, because of that 24/7 kind of aspect to it. And I hope that by making that final point, I've somehow rescued this soliloquy.
Ah, yeah, absolutely did. Don't worry at all. It's been excellent speaking to Rory. I do also notice within there, he wishes he'd written his piece a little bit differently, and it's not been very many hours since it's come out. That happens to people who do this sort of thing all the time, and I'm really pleased he was dead honest about it. The number of shows I've walked away from afterwards and thought, I really wish I'd really phrased that differently or that differently, and then you're left, well, you've got a cop for it, like anything else that's performative. Thank you very much to him. Let's get back over to everything else. Neil Atkinson, Tim O'Tierney, talking about Frequency.
Yes.
How is it?
It's good. It's good to have an album done, finished. You know, it's been a long time.
T Street Band's Frequency. Just in case people listen, I might not know you're the lead singer of T Street Band.
Not lead guitarist.
Yeah. I had to correct myself. Definitely then. Not, yeah. There's someone else steps that takes those shoes.
Yeah, it's like with a four piece. So Lee kind of plays all the MIDI stuff, does all like the sequencing stuff, keyboards, and then plays guitar fantastically. I play guitar and sing. Nick's doing loads of singing on this record, and he plays bass, and Dominic plays drums.
And it's your second album, in case people don't know. A lot of people probably do know that it's your second album. You know, you've been coming on and talking to us for ages,
Yeah. And
it's always good when you do. Let's be absolutely crystal clear about this. You want to see this one do well. You think it deserves to do well. I've heard it, so I think it's a belter. I think it's a really good album. But it's as much about what that means, isn't it? About the idea of what it leads to if people can get behind it.
Yeah, for us, it's like, you know, we've took the time to do it because we believed that we were going to do something which was pretty good. So obviously everyone says that about the record. I'm just more like, you know, I was saying to Oscar on the way, I was going, you know, if we go to Manchester and we do a gig, we're holding 150 people and there's 30 people there, I'd be really disappointed in like what live gig goers and new music buyers are kind of where they're at. So kind of like, if this does nothing and it's really, really, really crap and we don't sell any records, we potentially won't even do another record. We should probably just meet up and play covers or do whatever, because, you know, we just want it to do well and we want people just to get into it, really.
Do you want to, with it as well, it's the idea, I think, of, for people, the music industry is always changing. It's always changed. Yeah. There's not been a lot of people trying to talk like there was some sort of golden age, and things have always been different, and there's always a new tomorrow. But it's worth pointing out, isn't it, that where this album's concerned, one of the things that it can do, what you can do now, is you can have a top 20 album. That if people can get behind it in advance, so week one, you can have a top 20 album, and suddenly that conversation changes, playlisting changes, and you've got people's attention.
Everything changes. You know, we're working with Modern Sky, who were like, you know, really helping us. We've got a PR team behind it. We've got people who are plugging the records for us. We've got decent online, you know, funds to be able to do stuff to push into people's psyches. That's what you need to do for people to buy records. And I think we've got a good chance, you know what I mean? If people buy it and we can get them pre-orders up, there's no reason why we can't get a top 20 record, top 40. I'll be happy with top 40, but...
But it is... What that then does is, as I said, it means that, for instance, festivals next summer, you'll be on people's lists, you'll be on radar, playlists, all that sort of stuff.
It's like, you know, once you get a top 40, I can imagine, because I've never had it, but, you know, you start getting more radio, you're getting the festivals, which we need. We need to be playing at festivals. But I think we're a festival band, you know. It's like, whenever we played them, like we played Kendall Corn the other week, and it was brilliant. Loads of people came down, having a good time. It's good.
What's your ideal festival slot? What time do you want?
I want the Park Stage, Glastonbury, 6:30.
Half six?
Yeah.
And it's not been, has it been a hot day?
It's been all right. It's getting better.
It's getting better. Yeah. There's been smatterings of rain, but the crowds are beginning to crack. And then
people are getting ready for it, aren't they? And then we turn up and it's just like, brilliant.
Yeah, and then there's being able to get something going with an audience, because the thing I've seen you live so many times now. Yeah. We'll talk about the live shows coming up in a minute, but I think when I've seen you play festivals, and one of the things that I love from them is an audience that finds you and discovers what you're doing and gets into it there and then. Totally. That's what I know what you're like, because you're a gnarly character. You want the idea of what you've just come and seen us for the first time. You're come and have a bit of this.
Yeah, I remember playing Redmond Leeds, the dance tent. We played that like, I think it was 12 o'clock. We were opening the tent. No one there apart from a few little fiends, just still all up, all looking terrible. By the time we were 10 minutes in, the tent was rammed. We had like 2,000 people in. you know, never heard the band, didn't, and they were all dancing there having a good time. So that shows it works. So while we do that, now we get to these festivals, just by people buying the records.
Buying the records, it's called Frequency. It is out on the 9th of November, but you can pre-order it. I'll go into how, where, when and why on that in a second or two. Live show's coming up in November. People can buy tickets now. I know the one in Liverpool in District on the 16th is now very limited supply, but there's District in Liverpool on the 15th of November as well. And then Manchester Sunday, the 25th of November, and then you're playing in London on the 1st of December.
Yes.
It's interesting that you're playing weekends, basically. I know
Friday, Saturdays.
You've got jobs, but it's as much about the people who are coming, isn't it? You want people to be able to have the Friday, the Saturday, to really enjoy the weekend.
Yeah, I'm, you know, no disrespect to anywhere, but I don't think us, I'm 36, you know, it's like I go to work Monday to Friday. I can't get up on a Thursday morning after being somewhere dead far away playing to 25 people on a Tuesday night. There's no point. So we've picked out the weekend because we can work around them. We can go to work. Lee can have his family. You know, we can do things that we want to do as a band because it's all about making it work. Don't, you know, we're obviously putting our time in and loving it, you know, everything, but we can't be, you know, hindering our stuff.
Lives.
Yeah.
Lives and that.
Not stuff. Lives.
Lives and that. Other thing as well is those live shows, they are massive for you. They are all meant, and again, it's the, you want people turning up to enjoy themselves.
That's, right.
That's the point.
Yeah, 100%. It's like whenever we play live, it's all about making sure people enjoy themselves. You know, again, it's cliche, but we want people to come down and think, you know what, I really enjoy myself there. It's like, that's what we want from people all over.
So it is. If you go onto the T Street Band's Twitter now, it's T Street Band. That's on Twitter. You can find elsewhere, and you can use Google. But you Google the album Frequency. It's on Modern Sky Records. And you can sit there right now. You can order CD, vinyl, or you can just order the pre-order, the download right now as well. Any way that you want to get it. But it is worth pointing out that if this is an album that you would want to buy, it is better for the T Street Band if you do it now, if you do it week one, if you do it so that it's sitting there ready and waiting. That is the point. That is what we're trying to put over here, is that this makes a difference for bands, and it can make a difference for bands who don't necessarily play to the biggest crowds, but who can find, if they can harness the crowd's energy in one fell swoop, it can lead to further and further success quite quickly. Yeah. So you can do it right now. You can get it all lined up. It is Frequency. It is available right the way across all those platforms, and you can find it very easily indeed. Google it or go to the T Street Band's Twitter. It is at T Street Band. It's been a pleasure to have Timo knocking around the place.
Much.
No problem at all. Let's all get behind it. It is the Reds Bet segment of your weekend show. Neil Atkinson here. Reds Bet are partnering with the Anfield Rep through the entirety of 2018. We're very proud to have them on board with us. They give half of their profits back to Liverpool fan-related causes at Reds Bet and at Fans Bet, the nationwide arm. It's to fan-related causes, supporter causes right the way across the country. For instance, Shrewsbury Town. You have to nominate, though, which fan-related cause or organisation you'd like part of that to go back to. Please make sure you do that. To talk then this week through the odds, the first one that sort of strikes me is that Salah, Firmino and Mane to each score 15 or more Premier League goals is even money at the moment. I think you may be gambling there on injuries as much as anything else and or rotation. That is at even money. The next one that sort of strikes me is to go the whole Premier League 18-19 season unbeaten at home. Liverpool have not lost a league game going right the way back until Crystal Palace. Right the way, I think that is in May 2017. That's quite something. Liverpool were unbeaten last season. It's 5-1 that they'll go completely unbeaten this season. And another one that I like as well, which is a bit of a long-term one, is to beat Manchester City home and away in the Premier League and win the title. That is 9-1. I mean, what I would say is that if we do beat Manchester City home and away, it will put us in an excellent position to win the title. You'd have thought that would have really helped the Reds out across the course of the season. For this weekend, though, there is Aldo's picks. He's got Spurs and Manchester City to win and Liverpool and Chelsea to draw. That is 19-4. There's Aldo for you there doing the business. Backing against the Reds. It's like having Rob Gutman here, the man himself, backing there solidly against the Reds. Another one for this weekend is Virgil van Dijk to score a header. I think he's sort of due one. That is 19-1. That's got my attention as well. And for those of you who like the golf, Thomas Bjorn to lift the Ryder Cup and Liverpool to beat Chelsea in the Premier League is 5-1. 5-1 on Thomas Bjorn. Europe to win the Ryder Cup and Liverpool to beat Chelsea in the Premier League. That's 5-1. Listen, thank you very much indeed for listening to the Anfield Wrap all the way through. Thanks to Redbet for supporting us. Do be gamble aware. Gambleaware.co. Sportsocial.co.uk. All the information that you need is around on responsible gambling. Please do exercise that. And this segment is not about convincing people to take it up. It's about those, if you already are doing that sort of thing, feel free to do it with Redsbet. This is the Anfield Wrap.
I am with Mel Reddy, Adam Melia, and Paul Senior. And it's Paul Senior on the occasion of his fifth birthday, or more accurately, Motel Bar's fifth birthday in Liverpool City Centre. Paul, we've all lived, loved, disrobed, and been sacked there. Five years on. How is it to build a bar in this city?
Difficult. It probably is the most honest answer to that, because there's bloody millions of them. And it's spreading. Town is getting big. So you can't have everyone. So you've got to sort of realise what you've got and look after them, I suppose.
It's ebbed and flowed all the time since you've had it. I've known you for years working around it, and the Anfield Wrap used to have a studio there. So we know the journey that it's been on to some extent. But for listeners, it is worth pointing out that, you know, because it's got to its fifth birthday, it doesn't mean, as you say, it's always been flying, trading all bars in the city, pretty much, bar the obvious big ones, ebbs and flows all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was in its infancy quite tough. For us, it's not what I'd call a prestige location. That I've always said,
it's a weird location.
It's a very weird location.
Yeah.
You know, for an industry that is location, relied upon. Where we've always sort of said that you've got to walk over broken glass a little bit to get to us, especially for our customers who are sort of, I'd say, closely linked with Mojo, Salt Dog Slim, Sound. You know, they've got to sort of bash through Concert Square to get to us. But we also take a little bit from, not the fact that when they do that, you know, they've come to us for a reason. So, yeah, it's five. It is in its best health ever. We're doing really well at the moment. The guys that we've got there are outstanding.
Great selection. Strongbow, dark fruit. Adam, at what point does a bar become an institution?
I think when bars open, I think they quite often try and be all things to all people, and it's when they find their, I don't know, it's one of those unmeasurable things where you just sort of take the temperature of it, I guess. And I think that there's been probably at least a couple of, probably a year going on 18 months maybe now, where I think that Motel's just sort of like, you know, it feels normal where it is, even though it's in a strange place. It's not like you're kind of, you know, getting people that have been knocked back from every bar in Concert Square and then coming in Motel. it's a cool little thing, and I think people, I think that's when a bar hits its stride. And I think it's not the problem that sometimes happens with Liverpool bars is that they get dead popular and then they're ruined, because I've seen it happen to, well, the first bar I remember happening to was Heebie-Jeebies. I think it's brilliant. I saw a brilliant place, and then everyone starts going there, and then, you know, I don't know what the route is, but yeah,
I think Liverpool's always struggled with bars becoming too popular.
Yeah.
It's so odd actually, because not last weekend, the weekend before, we went out, and then it got towards the end of the night, and you thought, oh, let's go to all the, you know, regular haunts that you used to go to. So Maya, Brooklyn Mixer, Bar Bodega, like all those sort of places, and it was dead. And I was like,
weird, isn't it?
Where is everyone? Where do people go now? And that is the point, that popular places are popular for a short period.
Yeah.
And then, you know, things move on. So like you say, when a bar finds its identity and knows who it is, knows who its clientele is, and doesn't care really about being the in place, I think that's how it survives.
I think for us, we've just focused on trying to become a bit of a hangout, and not necessarily everything for all people, but just things where people use us for different things. So obviously we've had some great nights recently with the football, and, you know, thank you to a lot of the Anfield Wrap listeners and subscribers and contributors for sort of helping that along.
Doing a lot of heavy lifting from those contributors, aren't they, mate?
They've done some heavy lifting in that bar, yeah. And it's appreciated, you know, and it's been great to see. I mean, I suppose my highlight from Motel was must have been last season on that sort of Champions League run. I remember, I think it was the Roma game at home, just being stood behind the bar, sort of watching what was going on, and going, this is what I'm in it for. You know, I'm not a big drinker myself. I'm not particularly, you know, some people who get into bars are really hugely into the spirits and service side of it. You know, I'm just in it because I've just sort of fell into it over time, I suppose. And just when I was in there on that them nights, I was going, well, this is exactly what it felt like. The biggest time it had been a sort of reflection of my personality, you know, and that's what I wanted, was that everyone was in there having a good time, but also it was sort of the people I could associate with.
What are you doing Sunday night?
Sunday night, yeah. Well, probably losing loads of money. We've gone absolutely out of our way. We've got a big band on who reached out through the Anfield Rap again. So it was Rush, they're called. They play Albert Schloss in Manchester a lot. They look really, really good. I'm looking forward to having them. So, yeah, thanks for reaching out on that one. That's going to be good. We've got Luke's DJing, who's been sort of with us as long as I've been involved in motels. So he's... I think Luke's been probably involved in motel longer than I have. So yeah, Luke's DJing. The guys have got, have put a load of goodie bags and stuff together, and the beer and spirit brands have been very generous. So they're definitely worth getting your hands on. And yeah, just a major, very late piss up.
What time does it
start? Shirtless Gibber.
What time does it start? He's on holiday, unfortunately. What time does it start?
It's a shame.
Cardboard
cutters. We I think we're opening at 7:30, 8:00, but I think it'll really kick off from half nine until my license says I've got to close.
Sunday's the best day for drinking in Liverpool, in my opinion.
There we are. Can't argue with the facts. I trust Adam's opinion there. In fact,
me and Mel were talking to Craig outside before about a night where I think we played Man United, and the whole evening he thought it was Saturday, including when he woke up the next morning and it was Monday.
it's a bit of an interesting weekend from a sort of bar industry point of view, actually, because Mojo's 10 on Friday night, and they're doing their sort of pay what you feel thing and giving all the money to charity, which I think's commendable. It's amazing that they're doing that. Saturday night, another event that's big with sort of bar people. Botanical Gin Garden closes for the winter.
Yeah.
So they have a big, that's one I know you're close to, Mel. So they're having a big fireworks display, and then Motel Sunday. So everyone's going, I don't know how I'm getting through this weekend. That's the chat in the industry.
Liverpool will all stand together. We'll look after one another. There you go. That's everything that you need. Full industry rundown there from Paul Senior. Let's have a chat in a minute or two. Chelsea, Liverpool. Neil Atkinson, Paul Senior, Adam Mealy. You've just heard us talking about bars. Mel is a woman who's danced on a lot of tables in Liverpool City Centre. Are we going to be dancing Saturday night?
Hey, that is false advertising.
It's absolutely not false advertising. Go on.
Am I going to be out?
No. Are we going to be out? I don't know what you're going to be doing. You'll probably have to be grown up and cover it like a proper person. But are we going to get to go out after it?
I think so, yeah. I don't think the League Cup game is a true reflection of either side because of the changes we discussed. And in particular, I don't think Chelsea have the same unfamiliarity issue as Liverpool do, as we touched on. And I think Liverpool are very suited to the way Chelsea play under Sarri because it isn't the defensively disciplined Chelsea who can be quite obstructive and hurt you. I think it's a more expansive Chelsea with a Kante in a more advanced midfield position.
Which is a bit weird.
Yeah.
It was a bit weird last night, that, I thought.
Yeah, it's sort of been weird for them in general through the season because, I mean, when you think of Kante, you think about his incredible, practically superhuman ability to intercept the ball, to read, to anticipate, and he's really, really good at tackling.
It's a waste of him. It's a waste of a player. Yeah. I don't think he'll stay there if it carries on like that.
I'm all for multifunctionality and never pigeonholing a player. But I think when somebody is really that good, that absolutely superb in what they do, it's not the wisest decision to then try and make them something else. And it's odd because there've always been these very off, wrong, false comparisons between Kante and Naby Keita. And I think when you see Kante being used as a number 8, you can tell how they are very dissimilar. But I think definitely Roberto Firmino on Jorginho is one to watch because Chelsea this season have funneled everything through him. And when you put him under pressure, and West Ham showed, because he has that much of the ball, if you press well and if you close off passing lanes and he keeps getting the ball over and over again, you force him into mistakes. The issue West Ham had was there were so many counter-attacking opportunities that they never maximized. And obviously, they didn't have Arnautovic, so they were a bit blunt. But when I watched that game, the Chelsea-West Ham game, I thought to myself, you could see where Chelsea's weaknesses were, that you can force them to get a bit desperate, to get impatient. But I think the fact that they are enjoying the attacking freedom and the expression Sarri's allowed them to have on the ball in possession, I think Liverpool will find that interesting, because obviously Liverpool want to play teams that want to have the ball.
I think over the sort of the last 18 months, I think if I've watched any other side more than Liverpool, it's one that Maurizio Sarri's been the manager of. You know, I sort of fell in love with Napoli last season and sort of got to understand what he's about a little bit. And the Kante thing's really interesting, because obviously he's paired him with Jorginho, and that seems like a dream for a manager who sort of doesn't believe in pressing areas of the pitch. He just believes in pressing the ball. So Kante would, in my mind, what I understand of Ingo, like Kante would be sort of the player that he would build the side around. But I think West Ham, to a certain extent, did create a bit of a blueprint for Jorginho.
Can he turn around?
I think, yeah, oh, he can certainly turn around. He's a fantastic footballer, Jorginho. But what West Ham did, they let him have it. And that was really interesting for me. It was, we're gonna mark everybody else but you. Whereas I think the solution to Jorginho in the past has been to try and take him out the game, and he was allowed. It was probably the performance I've seen from Jorginho with the most mistakes in it, like, against West Ham, and he puts a lovely little ball, a lofted ball over the top, and it's the only real time you got to see him be Jorginho. And I think I wonder whether Klopp might just bypass him or Roberto, make him Roberto Firmino's business, you know. So if Chelsea want the ball, well, we'll let Firmino press you, but we'll deal with you individually in a different way than you would usual.
I'm dead interested to see what team Sarri picks, because for me they've shown more of themselves than we've shown of ourselves last night. It was interesting that Trent and Robertson weren't even on the bench, because that is the big difference, as well as the front three. There was loads of space in behind, and that front three just, you know, they must have been licking their lips looking at it. And for me, you know, as I say, I think it's a waste of a player like Kante to have him on the end of chances at the edge of the box. And I'd be more worried if he, you know, picked Kovacic or somebody instead of Kante, to be honest. I thought Kovacic was really good.
I think he'll pick them both. I think he'll pick Kovacic and Kante.
I think with Sarri, the team is quite often the team. Sarri will quite often sacrifice competitions. I think we've seen that last season with Napoli, where they seen the importance of winning the league. So we just completely abandoned the Champions League. The only time he really made changes, and it was a big thing for Napoli to sort of be in the Champions League, and people thought they could have gone far with that side. But he abandoned it because all he wanted was the league. And I think if Chelsea in 6 weeks' time are a real player in the league, I wouldn't be surprised. Obviously, it's Europa League for them this year, but whether the focus is we're going to try and play 38 games with pretty much that 11, that is the blueprint, and that's how we win the league.
Yeah, I mean, and I think you're right. I think they will play. I think he will play the team, and I think he will play the system, because that's what he does. But I just think that they might be. I've been thinking it for weeks that they're in for a nasty surprise. I think we're made to play them. I'm not concerned about Mariner particularly. I think he's one of the better referees, because I think that does make a difference at Stamford Bridge quite a lot of the time.
Has hair.
Yeah, and a nice tan. I think we're gonna whack him.
I like that sort of talk. Have both managers played the hand, Mel? Because I feel as though the substitutions maybe tell the story of what we can expect the two lineups to be. I don't think there'll be a ton of surprises in there. There's maybe Liverpool have got to pick three from four in central midfield. I expect it to be Wijnaldum, Milner and Henderson.
Yeah, I don't think there were. I don't think either manager, if you remove last night from the equation, we're going to be in doubt over what the other were going to do, because they are two men who steadfastly
believe
in their way. And, you know, we've seen the players that have performed well for Liverpool thus far this season. We've seen, conversely, who have done that for Chelsea. So, yeah, neither surprise in either lineup, like you say. It's just midfield where there's a question mark of who he goes for. But I think he'll look to go steal at Stamford Bridge rather than any sort of wild card per se. You can have game changers on the bench if you need them, but you don't want Chelsea to have the opportunity to set any sort of tone or to get any sort of comfort in the game, because we saw last night when you offer them an inch, they will gladly accept it.
Giroud can be expected to start. Hazard obviously expected to start. We've got to have some degree of a plan here.
Pedro as well, if he starts Willian last night.
But he hooks Willian. So that's your question mark for them. I think your question mark for them is he does Willian quite early. So I would normally expect Pedro, but I wonder if, because it does, he'll have the idea of Pedro's more get on the end of things, Willian's more will come back in and get involved. I think that could go either way is what I'm saying, but I think that's your only question mark for them, because Giroud will start and we'll have to have a plan for both Giroud. He scores against us last season. Mm-hmm. When Van Dijk was playing, by the way, this isn't like Owen Virgil's going to come in and sort everything one. And obviously Hazard is going to be worth worrying about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've said earlier in the show, haven't we, just how much we rate Eden Hazard. Giroud's been really interesting, and there were some stats knocking about Hazard with and without Giroud, and his width are a concern for me. And as you said, we go to Stamford Bridge towards the end of last season, where I feel like it wasn't a massively important game, but felt like Liverpool were in a bit of an ascendancy. And you could have took something from it. Van Dijk was there, and I'm a little bit
just had the away leg in Rome, hadn't we?
Yeah, I'm a little bit worried about Giroud. I wish they wouldn't have found the relationship between Hazard and Giroud, because there's now that guy who's going to be the selfless guy who enables Hazard, and that's my biggest concern about Chelsea for Hazard, stop moving forward.
Yeah. Hazard has come out and said he genuinely enjoys playing with him. They've got sort of a telepathy. I mean, that doesn't sound too good for Morata.
No.
But it is concerning. But at the same time, I think that would have been one of the core things Liverpool would have looked at and thought, this has been central to Chelsea doing so well thus far the season. And I think we're in the air where in the past we've had to rely on Van Dijk so heavily last season. I think Gomez has been superb in the air.
And Alisson as well.
And Alisson is very, very strong and, you know, coming to claim and things like that. So I don't look at what happened at the end of last season and draw conclusions from it because of that.
I think also where Alisson puts the line helps this massively as well. It means balls over.
So noticeable last night that the line's dropped back, you know, to where Mignolet likes it. And I was thinking about Gomez, as Mel just says, I was thinking about Gomez last night as one of the players that, you know, he's not on the bench and I'm fine with it. But, you know, how well he did when he came on against Southampton. Am I right?
Yeah, you are right, yeah.
My mind went blank then. Just made me think that I'm just looking forward to seeing him come back into the side, because he's just been fantastic.
Henderson's my biggest question mark, whether he goes with Henderson or whether he goes Wijnaldum, Keita, Milner. I think he might go Henderson for height.
I think with the substitutions, how they went shows you that he's probably going Henderson as well, because Keita stays on for longer, doesn't he?
Look at the 90. Last night. Yeah. Give me a prediction, Paul.
I fancy us, but only by the one.
Adam? Earlier talk of whacking.
Whacking. Yeah, I know, but then we started talking about Hazard and Giroud and their relationship, so I think maybe it'll be 6-1 now.
Okay.
Not really. I don't know. 3-1, though.
3-1. Mel?
2-1, Liverpool.
Excellent stuff. I would take a draw, ladies and gentlemen.
If we draw against Chelsea and City, then we stay top.
Yeah.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That is the way in which apart from goal difference, we stay at least level on points with everybody else. That is worth bearing in mind. Thank you very much indeed to Paul, to Adam, and to Mel. She'd never be seen on a table, really.
Sports Social Podcast Network.